Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. First, Mary Radu. Mary is the author of Roadmap to Meaningful Midlife. Also, the Philanthropy from the Inside Out program and founder of Pathmaker Coaching. Mary is a pioneer in the emerging third age and midlife transitions field, specializing in midlife career and lifestyle transitions, especially for those in the baby boomer age group. She's the founder and general chairperson of the Northern California Life Planning Network, as well as the vice president for the National Life Planning Network, a community of professionals helping people navigate the second half of life. Also on our panel is Ben Yohannan. Ben is president of Hatch Retirement Services. He began his career in financial services in 1991, specializing in retirement plans such as 401k, 403b, IRAs, to name a few. Now he's the principal of the firm his father started in 1977. As a second-generation investment advisor, Ben helps an increasing number of people hatch their retirement nest eggs. Also, we want to welcome back attorney Elizabeth Cravazzi. Elizabeth is passionate about helping Bay Area seniors plan for the best possible future, choosing when, where, and how they will live, drafting wills and trusts that both reflect their values and protect their assets, and preparing for potential incapacity and decisions about end-of-life care. An estate planning and elder law attorney based in Sausalito, California, Elizabeth's work combines a lifetime of professional, personal, and volunteer experiences to help clients fully understand the legal and family relationship consequences of their decisions. Elizabeth lives in Sausalito with her husband of 31 years and a big yellow lab who sheds all year long. Mary, will you lead off the panel?
Thank you, John. We're glad to have you joining us tonight for the second part of this two-part series focusing on longevity planning so that you can create the best future for yourself. For those of you who weren't here on September 21st for part one, we want to invite you to listen to the podcast recording that you can find on the Commonwealth Club's website. You can use the search button and search by the word longevity or use one of our speakers' names tonight, and you'll find that podcast. During these two sessions, we're focusing on three aspects of longevity planning that will help you take stock of your resources, primarily your financial and material resources. There are essentially three things that you can do with your tangible resources. You can enjoy them, yay! We can grow them, or we can give them away. In the first session, we focused on enjoying our resources, spending them during our lifetime, and that involved developing an income plan. We also talked about growing your resources, which was for saving for the future, including for contingencies like expenses such as healthcare, which we can expect to need in the future. In today's part two of longevity planning, we're going to focus on giving your resources away. Yes, we're going to focus on intentionally sharing your resources during this phase of your life, as well as when you're gone. We'll be looking at some of the tangible and intangible ways that you can create a personal legacy to be remembered by your family and your community. I'll begin by addressing the longevity, the legacy planning and how it fits into your life plan. And then it'll be followed by the two panelists, my fellow panelists, who will be specifically looking at financial and legal aspects and the vehicles that you can use for implementing your legacy planning. We encourage you to write down some questions as we go along. We're going to have a Q&A session at the end of our presentations. So gather your ideas as we go along, and you'll have an opportunity to ask them later. So why is legacy planning important for you? In part one, we talked about how the extended life spans in our society meant that many people are living into their 70s, their 80s, their 90s, and that they're living with new opportunities for staying active and involved. Many in the room indicated that they had 10 to 20 plus years left to live ahead of them. And as we move into the second half of life, we begin to shift away from some of the outward tasks that we've had in our midlives, our earlier lives, where we were creating our careers, we were growing our families, raising our families, and we were managing external imposed expectations that were upon us. We begin to recognize that collecting material possessions may not be as important at this stage of our lives as having our inner lives, having meaningful experiences and relationships. We sense and change the changes in ourselves and the people around us, and we there are concerns that get raised about our own mortality and losing control over our lives. We begin to realize that our time here is limited. There are some big questions that arise at this time in our lives. The first is, what's my purpose? What am I here for? What do I still want to accomplish? Where do I want to go from here in my life? What will I pass on to my family and my community for which I can be remembered? And what do I want to leave to make the world a little bit better than I found it? So, legacy planning comes out of these questions. We all leave a legacy of some kind, positive or negative. We create it every day in the way we deal with everyday circumstances that we respond to, in the choices we make. Whether it's us barking at the young mother with the boisterous children in the checkout line in the grocery store, or how we interact and deal with our families, our neighbors, our friends. Legacy planning is about intentionally choosing to live your life in such a way that it will be valued and can be valued and modeled by others. It's about making decisions, intentional, conscious decisions, about how we use our time, our money, our material assets, our talents, in consideration of the effect that it'll have on the world around us as well as on future generations. We can build our legacy now in the way we live, in the contributions we make while we're present. But we can also prepare a legacy that we can give away when we're no longer here. Legacy building can be the most important work of our second half of life. And we can continue it to our last breath. As we said in our last session, intentional planning puts us in the driver's seat for our lives. It reduces the risks of unintended legacies and loss of control. It clarifies our choices, and it increases our options for maintaining control over our life circumstances and creating the legacy that we want. Let me tell you a story about one person and her legacy that she intentionally built. This is a real woman here in the Bay Area who passed away about a year ago. She lived into her mid-80s, a very vibrant person. She started her life as a mother and a wife, raised children, and she spent the second half of her life as a single woman. During her lifetime, she was a strong believer in equal rights and in helping people and sharing with people who had less than she did. She made time during her adult life, even while she was raising her children, to volunteer. And she used the skills that she had as a nurse to help people here in this country as well as overseas. When her children began to have their children, she made a conscious decision that she wanted to help them. And she also wanted to do it in such a way that she could spend quality time with her grandchildren. So she made a commitment to spend one day a week with her grandchildren. At her memorial service when she passed away, one of her grandsons shared a legacy letter that she had written to him on the event of his first birthday that she was not able to share with him that year. She expressed in that letter her hopes for him, for the life that he would live, and also for the world that he would grow up in. In the year after her death, her children started a family foundation with some of their inheritance and also money that they added into the pot. Her grandchildren, they participated in soliciting ideas from friends and family members about organizations that fit the causes that their grandmother cared so much about. Her legacy continues every year as her children and her grandchildren select those current year's grants. And her grandchildren continue to honor her values. And it's expected, I would expect, that they will be passing those along to their own children. I want to state three important questions. Let's see whether I can get these up. Okay. Three important questions in defining your legacy, for uncovering what it might be. These questions will most likely require that you spend some time in introspection. They're big questions. The first is, what do I most want to leave behind for my family and loved ones to remember me that expresses what I value and stand for? You may immediately think about your material wealth and possessions. However, in addition to that, you may want to leave other tangible reminders of about yourself so that your loved ones can remember you and can also pass it on to future generations. Some forms to consider are personal and family stories in writing or in oral recordings, some family stories in pictures, family recipes, items that you've handcrafted, or other reminders of what you stand for in your life. You might also want to write legacy letters or ethical wills, which express the intangible values that are important to you and pass on your wishes about how you want to be dealt with if you were to be incapacitated and what you would like people to do after you're gone. The second question is, how can I begin to build that positive legacy while I'm here using the resources that I have available at my disposal? We all have resources. We have an opportunity to leave a legacy until our last breath, as I mentioned before. This can be through the values that we express in our interactions every day. You may value love. You may value learning. You may value self-determination. You may value integrity. So these are all values that you can be expressing and choose to express in the way you deal with situations. We can take positive control of our health and our nutrition and maintain our independence to the degree possible as we age. Those are legacy decisions because they impact other people. We can share our end-of-life wishes with our families, so when the time comes that we cannot speak for ourselves, our families won't struggle with the decisions of what it was that we would want in those situations, especially at the time when it's particularly emotionally difficult. We can choose to volunteer our time and use our financial resources to aid organizations and causes that we care about. There may be undone work that you have to do. There may be a book waiting in you. There may be some travel adventure that you still need to carry out while you're here. And these are things that you can carry on and express your legacy of your vibrancy and your aliveness throughout your life. The third question is, what planning can I do to make sure that my legacy wishes will be carried out when I can no longer decide? My partners are going to be addressing these important questions and the structures that you can put in place to be able to ensure that your wishes for yourself and for others are carried out when you're incapacitated and when you're gone. So we're going to move on to the next portion of the program, where we're going to have a little discussion here of financial and legal issues with Ben and Elizabeth. And I'm going to be leading a few questions that we'll be directing to the two of them. And then we're going to have a little conversation. Again, after we finish this conversation, I'm going to be coming back to a few next steps that you can take and give you some tools that you can take some next steps with that build on their comments. And then we'll have a Q&A session. So the first question that we're going to address is that I'd like Ben and Elizabeth to look at is, what impact will our longevity, the additional lifespan that we have that our prior generations didn't experience, what will our longevity impact be on what we have left to give when we're here as well as when we're gone? You want to go first?
Sure. Well, at the first session, Mary asked the question, how much longer do we think we have on this earth? And we raised our hands depending on what time frame we thought that was. One thing that's interesting about longevity is a study was done in 2007 by the Society of Actuaries, and they basically confirmed or found that individuals often underestimate how long they're going to live by 5 years. So whatever number you had or have today, you might want to add 5 years to that. So that provides us a challenge with respect to how do you spread out your resources and make that last over a lifetime. Another statistic I'm going to throw out is the concept of lifespan or life expectancy. Two healthy 65-year-olds today, male and female, there's a 50% chance that one of those two individuals will actually live to age 92. And then there's a 25% chance that one of those individuals will live to 97. So I've got a coin in my pocket. It's a question of, are you going to live to 92 or not? We'll find out. But I think that's an interesting thing to think about, is that we often underestimate our life expectancy or our lifespan, and I think it behooves us to actually plan for it. I'm going to bet on your longevity.
Well, in the fastest growing segment of the population in California today are people 100 years old and older. Think about that. My grandmother lived to be 106. It was very unusual when she did that. But the chances of us sitting in this room, 25% of us will go beyond 100 years. Now, that's positive, and it's got its negative side. Myself, I'm thinking cat food at 100, I don't know. But it's something to keep in mind as you look at your resources, you consult with your professionals, you look at your own planning. It's a long time to come, a lot of time to get it right.
Anything else that you'd like to add, Ben?
Well, one of the things that Ben will talk about is that as we live longer, one of the things we're all going to face are the incredible costs of health care and long-term care insurance and the difference between those two.
Right. So when we talk about planning for spending more money on health care, again, I'm a big believer that there are three acts or three phases of retirement. And when building an income plan to address those increased expenses, it's when forecasting what things are going to look like in the future, it's very hard to say if you're 65 today what it's going to be like when you're 80. I completely understand that. But in building plans, you can play what-if scenarios. And one way of doing that is after establishing what your budget is, as you move through those different phases, and I mentioned this in the last presentation, is apply lifestyle factors to your spending habits. And what I mean by that is if you're spending 100%, or if your number for healthcare is $5,000 a year right now, then in addition to adding an appropriate inflation rate, which probably should be around 7% as opposed to normal CPI that's typically used at 3%, because if you carve out health care expenses, it's going at much higher rates than normal inflation. So you want to apply the right inflation factor, but then you might want to bump that up by 25-35% depending on whether you have a long-term care policy or not. If you don't have a long-term care policy in place, then you might want to increase that lifestyle factor, because those expenses can be can be quite high. Here in the Bay Area, for a full-skilled community, I'm sure you can speak to this too, it can exceed $80,000, $90,000 a year.
And the important thing here is that you have your medical out of pocket, right? Your deductible on your insurance, the donut hole on your prescription coverage, all of those things that happen after 65. But beyond that is long-term care, which is assistance with the activities of daily living, which is not covered by Medicare or Medi-Cal, and that you've got to come up with either by self-funding or insurance or have a very terrific family that's going to be available to help you with those things. So not only are we all planning for how are you going to pay your deductible and your prescription costs, but how are you going to provide for your care? I have a client now in a nursing home with a long-term care policy, very significant. The policy pays $7,800 a month in benefits as long as he stays in a convalescent hospital or a nursing home. He wants to go home, but his policy only provides $3,500 a month for at-home care. So even as you look into these policies, and Denise is here, she was here at our last panel, she can talk to you about crafting a policy that addresses the kind of need that you might need or that your parents might need. So that's one of the issues.
Yes, and I think to really bring home the point, long-term care is different than health care premiums. It's a, you know, it's something that we hope never happens, but being prepared is probably a better position to be in than not looking at those circumstances. And you have three choices. You can either self-insure because you have substantial resources to do so. And if so, then there are other strategies that you may want to look at. But if you're kind of the mass affluent in the middle, then you're a prime candidate for looking at that as an option for your planning through the phases of retirement.
And this really is a legacy planning issue, because if you haven't made plans to take care of yourself, then your family will. And it's been estimated in a recent report by the New York Times that families that are paying to support their parents or grandparents in long-term care are paying anywhere from $250,000 to $300,000 at the end of their lives. That's a really big burden on your kids who are trying to educate their kids or plan for their retirements with their former 401ks that are now 201ks and dropping like a rock, right? So it's a part of your legacy is taking care of yourself as best you can. And if the answer is I don't know how I'm going to do that, this is a conversation to have now with your kids and with your advisor so that you can make plans.
Yeah, and this can be a conversation with your attorney, your insurance expert, your financial advisor, and you can culminate opinions from all of your resources, even neighbors and family. So it's a dialogue to actually have, and even though it's uncomfortable dialogue to have in, often.
And again, I want to reiterate that this is a lifestyle decision that has a huge impact on your family and your friends. And the more you can research and do your homework on this, even if you can't afford long-term care, there are other resources. Find out what those resources are in your community so that your children and your close friends don't have to do all the legwork when you're in a crisis. So I want to ask Ben and Elizabeth whether there are any other obstacles or problems beside long-term care and health care expenses that might impact my ability to leave a material legacy.
Well, I think you need the right legal documents in place so your wishes actually do get carried out, and I'm sure Elizabeth can speak to that.
I always tell my clients that estate planning is really life planning. And we'll sit down to talk, and I'll get all the documents ready, and I'll sit down to sign them, and I'll give them the first document. What do you think the first document is that I give a client? Advanced health care directive. That's about your life and your end of life. And it's the very most important document that you have. You can get it done by an attorney. You can go online. I have some resources. But this is something absolutely every person needs. And if you have kids who've recently gone to college, make sure they do one separately, because if they're over 18, you can no longer direct their medical care in an emergency. You don't have the right to do that. So it's something to think about. So certainly an advanced health care directive. The second is a durable power of attorney for financial management. There's a statutory form in California. It's available online that you can do. You'll have to have it certified, notarized. This would direct someone to be able to pay your bills for you if you're incapacitated. My focus when I do estate planning is what matters to me is what happens while you're alive. All right? That's the most important thing. What happens to your stuff after you're gone is of secondary importance. All right? So, advanced health care directive, a durable power of attorney for financial management, and finally, a will or a trust. You do not want to die intestate in the state of California. It will cost your family money and trouble. I'm right now probating my mother's estate. It is a nightmare. You know how it is. Your mother would never let her lawyer daughter do anything for her, right? So those are the three absolutely essential documents.
And Elizabeth, is it true that each state has their unique advanced medical directive?
Well, it's interesting. There's a website called Compassion and Choices, and I have that on a sheet here for you as well. And they actually have a 50-state review. But if you have a California Advanced Health Care Directive and you're traveling, as long as you have it or you register it with the Secretary of State in California, almost every state in the union will honor it if you're traveling. The difficulty can be if you're traveling overseas, but there are some things we can do about that as well.
That same website, Compassion and Choices, also has a toolkit on it called the Good to Go Toolkit that gives you some great ideas about how to have these conversations with your family. And sometimes that's the most difficult piece.
And if I can interject for a second. So while these legal documents are extremely important to have in place, they're meaningless unless you actually execute on them. So what I mean by that is if you own your home and you get set up a trust and you don't change over the ownership of that home to your trust, just because you have the trust doesn't mean that that piece of property is held in trust and that would be subject to probate. Another thing that you need to be extremely careful of too is on your retirement accounts, you have named beneficiaries, which supersedes what you say in your trust.
Same with your life insurance.
Thank you. As well as with your life. So anything that has a named beneficiary, in most cases, is going to stand alone and be independent of how your trust reads.
Right. So it's important to look at the whole picture. Your retirement accounts, your life insurance policies. If you have a transfer on death or a pay on death account, perhaps with a grandchild, something like that, you need to look at the whole picture so that you know what's actually going to be available to take care of you if you're unable to take care of yourself, especially.
And I could spend 30 minutes talking about pitfalls and traps on how you set up beneficiaries. So rather than do that, I'm just going to say it's important to do frequent beneficiary reviews just to make sure things are set up exactly how you'd like it.
Are there any other legal or financial documents that people should be thinking about as they're creating a legacy plan?
Most people, if you have a simple estate, people simply need a will. But a simple estate is really pretty simple these days. We live complicated lives. So if you are a single person and you don't own any real estate and you have a couple of bank accounts and a retirement fund, you can probably get by with a simple will and beneficiary designations. However, if you're in a second marriage, if you have yours, mine, and ours children of any age, but particularly if you have children of different ages, okay, if you have a child who has a special need, a developmental disability, a drug problem, if they have a credit problem, if they're constantly getting in trouble and you want to be able to provide for them but not make that available to their creditors, you're going to need to do a little more planning. Also, if you own any special assets, if you own real estate, certainly if you own it in more than one state, if you have a family business and you're trying to plan for the next generation to remain active in that business, that will require some planning. And if in California, it's so interesting. Other attorneys in other states don't get this, but we're in California. Intellectual property. So many people have intellectual property in California, and you need to make provisions for that because that is property when you die.
And I suppose another comment, which I know you don't have this expertise, but this would be something to seek out, but same-sex couples really need to do their extra homework with the way how things are in flux here right now.
I was telling Ben, I did one same-sex couple's estate plan because they're dear, dear, old friends. And I thought, well, how hard can this be? incredibly hard. It is very complicated, partly because the law is in flux. So you can do just trust that take care of each partner, but you want to include language that says, what if California finally recognizes same-sex marriage? What if the federal government does it? Because then you get the marital deduction. So this poor couple, the trust was like 60 pages long. We needed a cart to haul it around, but it was incredibly complicated. I will not do another one because you really need someone, and I hired someone to help me do it. So you want someone who's really expert in that area.
Great. Elizabeth, I during my presentation, I talked a little bit about legacy letters and ethical wills. I know you do a lot of work with ethical wills with your clients. Would you just tell us a little about that?
There are certain spiritual traditions that require an ethical will. In certain parts of Judaism, for example, a person is expected to leave an ethical will, which expresses your values and communicates to your family sort of what your life has meant and what you hope for them. There are many books if you check them, but this is the one that I use with my clients by Dr. Barry Baines. You're welcome to come look at this. Let me just tell you a story about an ethical will. A friend of mine's mother recently passed away, and among all the paperwork and the siblings and the difficulties and so on, we discovered an ethical will that she had written about 25 years ago. She has three children, two sons and a daughter. They're in enormous pain and conflict right now for lots of reasons. This will talks about each of these children, who they are, who she imagined they would be at their birth, who they've become, because they're all in their 60s now, and her hopes for them, including her hope that no matter what happens, they will commit to each other and the central value of family. I tell you what, we've got all these people threatening to sue each other, and I pull out Mom's ethical will. What do you think happened? It was miraculous, that's all I can tell you. It made a huge difference to this family, and it's something she did 25 years ago.
So in that regard, can you maybe speak to how it's really, that it's not so much a legal document, but really a guide?
It's a letter that you write to your family and tells them, you tell your family what's important about being in your family, who you are, what you've worked to create for your family, what you'd like them to carry forward for you. It's more of value statements, and it's stories. She told stories about when they were little kids and how they worked together to accomplish something. It was amazing. And it's not fancy. It's not, you know, in some big document. It's just a handwritten letter that she left behind. It was wonderful.
Great. So we're going to end this section, and we're going to move on to, unless the two of you have anything else that you want to add, we will have time during the Q&A to address some other questions about these topics. So we're going to move on to the final part of our program before the Q&A, and that is we want you to get started, and there are some proven ways to help you get started on your legacy planning.
Well, what I do to help clients when I meet a new client is we take them through the process of what we call a nest egg analysis. So in fairness to enjoy, grow, give, that's, if you spell that out, that's with the first letters, that's egg. That's how why we call it a nest egg analysis. And it's just a starting point, you know, a place to take stock of where you're at. And then you basically, and we've had clients say, I don't like the word stress test. But that's what we do. We stress test it against the major risks that are in retirement, which we are in your handouts, and we went over that quite a lot. But for sake of the radio audience, to remind them, that's longevity itself, investment risk, inflation, distribution rate, sequence of returns, which really means terrible timing. You start withdrawing money in bear markets, and rising healthcare costs. So look at those risks and take stock of your resources and how they apply to those risks and formulate a plan.
I would say if you leave here today, one of the most important things to do is think about who in your circle of family and friends are the most trustworthy people. Because what you're going to be asking them to do is to make healthcare decisions for you if you're unable to make them yourself. So they need to really know you and what's important to you and what you value. And then you're going to need someone who can manage your money for you if you're unable to do this. And, of course, you've heard all the nightmare stories about what happens when that's not done appropriately. This is a good time to think about that before you're in crisis. And I would also suggest that you have at least two so that there's an alternate. All right? That would be my suggestion.
And the last suggestion I'm going to say is that talk to your kids. Have communication with your kids, open communication. I see more strife and more problems just because the different generations are actually not talking to each other. And it goes both ways, by the way. So that was my final thoughts.
So as you carry out these steps, you're all going to have your own specific area that's the most concern for you. The point is, get started now. Do it when you're not in crisis. Brain research confirms that we make much better decisions when we are calm and when we have all of our facilities available to us. And do this now when you have the opportunity to use this legacy planning, this planning as a way of communicating with your family. Use it as a family building experience. It's an opportunity at this point in your life. Take it one step at a time. Make it manageable. Every large thing that you have accomplished in your life, whether it was raising a family or getting a college education or creating a career, you did one step at a time. So this is not any different than that. So if you break it down into manageable steps, you'll be able to keep your energy flowing and keep in action, which is what's going to be needed because complicated lives, there are many pieces to this puzzle. So what's important is to stay in action. And thirdly, I want to reiterate finding support. Positive aging research indicates that to thrive in older age, we need to have a strong support system. So this is a wonderful opportunity to do that and to build it around the kinds of needs that you might potentially need as you grow older. And as you aren't able to do the things for yourself that you've been able to do before. That ought to be a network, as Elizabeth and Ben were talking about, a network of family that you trust, friends that you trust, and trusted advisors. Advisors who understand integrated planning. Planning that focuses on all of you as a person, your values, as well as your lifestyle goals. So there are resources, people like us that work with these kinds of issues. There's a growing number of professionals around the country who are recognizing the need because we're aging ourselves. We're seeing the need for ourselves. And we're connecting with each other as Ben and Elizabeth and I have. And we talk with each other and learn from each other so that as we provide our piece of the puzzle, we can look at the whole person that we're dealing with. So those are the three points for taking action. Start now, make it manageable, take baby steps, and third of all, find support. So before we go to the Q&A, I want to ask each of you to think about what is that one main item around your legacy planning that's critical to you right now. What's the one that keeps you up at night? What's the one that's hard to talk about? What's the one that you know you really need to do because it's the right thing for you and it's the right thing for your family? So pick that thing and then look at what's the first step. What's that next small step? It might mean you sit in a room by yourself and you think about what's important about that for you and you do some writing. It might mean that you call someone and you set up an appointment, whether it's with that family member or that trusted friend or advisor. But think about it and take that one step, identify it, put it on your calendar, and do it because it may be the most important step that you take. So we're going to turn it over to you, our audience, and have a question and answer session.
We'd like to remind our listening audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to our longevity panel with Mary Radu, Ben Yohanan, and Elizabeth Cravazzi. We have questions, I'm sure, so let's begin.
a brave soul in the back.
Hi, I'm a University of California employee, and closer. Right. Sounds boomy. But,
I know.
And I'm anticipating retirement, you know, at some point. I still have three kids to put through school, so it's way off. But we have the opportunity, if we want, rather than take this annuity, to take a buyout. And I'm concerned about California's ability to deliver long-term on annuities. I'm also concerned that if I have a brother and sister that have been ill, younger, if I were to die, that my children would get nothing if I didn't take a buyout. And, you know, I'm wondering, I'm also, even if the annuity, the set annuity comes through, I'm not sure the value with the changing currency, the value of currency is going to remain constant or comparable. So I'm wondering, does it make sense to invest in something like, you know, buy rentable property that will have some intrinsic value? Or?
I have some thoughts on that. One of your concerns that you mentioned in your question is the viability of that annuity payment and the problems that California is having. So first you'd want to find out who is going to be responsible for that annuity. Is the university, are they self-managing that those payments, or are they outsourcing to an insurance company? So then it becomes a question of how safe is the insurance company. Another key question you have is inflation. The annuity payments, is there going to be a COLA with that or not? That would enter your decision making process. And with regards to, do you take the lump sum or an income stream? I think going through the process of measuring how important guaranteed income is to you. So there's some tools out there that you can measure and test how important a guaranteed income stream is to you. If you should test on something like that and it's of low importance, then that would seem to steer you towards taking a lump sum. However, if it should show that it's a high importance to you to have guaranteed income, then the annuity stream may be a better option for you. So you want to take a look at what your budget is now and forecast what it would be in retirement and then see if your current guaranteed income sources can meet your needs, and if so, take the lump sum.
This question is really for Elizabeth. Would you expound a little bit, please, on this durable power of attorney for finances and how that differs from setting up a conservatorship?
Well, thank you for that question. It's really a good one. The whole point of creating these documents, like the Advanced Healthcare Directive and the Durable Power of Attorney and a trust, if that's appropriate, is to avoid conservatorship. Because what you've done in advance is said, when I'm unable to make these decisions for myself, either because I've decided I'm just tired, I don't want to do it, or in fact you have some sort of incapacity, some cognitive loss, then you've already made arrangements. So there's no reason for the court to be involved. Of course, that's why it needs to be someone very trustworthy, right? Because this person is not going to be overseen by the court system. In the documents that I do, and all attorneys that I know do this, the durable power of attorney will include a nomination of conservator, should that be necessary. So you've already expressed your wishes that if for some reason everything else falls apart, if a court is involved, you've already told the court who you want to serve in those roles. Does that help?
That helps a lot. Then the follow-up question to that would be, if this is someone's paying the bills, is it important that it be someone, say, within the Bay Area rather than someone out of state?
It's easier but not impossible. For example, particularly now with online banking, you can do a lot from anywhere, right? Everything gets paid online. The other issue is, say you had a sufficiently large estate to be managed, then your designated person could hire what's called a private professional fiduciary who is licensed and bonded in the state of California to pay bills and essentially operate like a bookkeeper for the person that you're appointing. And most durable powers of attorney, one of the powers they will have is the power to hire the professional help they need, whether it's a bookkeeper or a bill-paying service or an accountant, so that you're not asking this person to do all those jobs. You just want them to manage it just like you would if you needed that kind of help. Thank you.
So I'm the other part of this planning in our family. And we've been great planners over the years. We just finished, we spent all summer working on our legacy, our estate planning, and bringing it up to date after a number of years. I think we were in our 40s when we invested in long-term care insurance. And Consumers Reports said the place we were, we chose was the very best. And now they've gone bankrupt. And now he's in his 70s, I'm in my late 60s. And we really can't, I don't think we can get new long-term care insurance at our age. We've put a bundle of money in it. We went high, we went the high end on this. And all we know is we have to wait until the state of Pennsylvania, is it time? In the state of California decides what they're going to do about this. So every year we ask, are we going to continue to invest in it? Are we going to invest in the high end or the low end or the middle end? And we don't have any answers. What do we do?
You talk to somebody like Denise, who's in the back of the...
We did that.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. And there are other... So if there's trouble in qualifying for long-term care now, then there may be what are called hybrid products, which are either annuities or life insurance that then can be leveraged to pay for long-term care that don't quite have the same underwriting as a traditional long-term care policy does. Short of that, I don't have a great answer for you.
I want to add something. I want to point out that you've done all the right things. You've spent the time in your earlier life before you saw before the need occurred to think forward about what the need might be as you grew older. And I want to encourage people to continue to do that. The point is that we can't always know what kinds of unforeseen situations are going to happen. But my guess is that a lot of the planning that you've put in place is solid, and it's still firm, and it's there ready for you when the need arises. There's this one piece of the puzzle that didn't work out for you, but that and there are other pieces of your planning puzzle that are still solid and firm and ready there for you. So I want to make sure that people recognize that we can't always control everything, but that planning helps reduce the risk.
Just a question. Just to follow these two fine people, what are you supposed to do if that happens? You know, a company goes bankrupt, you no longer have a policy or whatever, and what recourse can you take? And what's your recommendation for this type of situation?
When it's a company as big as that one, you're looking at the attorney general for the state is the plaintiff on behalf of the public, as well as class action lawsuits. And most of these, and Denise, correct me if I'm wrong, most of these policies, there is some guarantee through the insurance, right? The Guarantee Association.
Yes.
It's pennies on the dollar, but there is some effort to provide consumer protection.
Yeah, so unfortunately, I know the situation that the policy that they were recommended was from a company that had a low financial rating and, you know, attached to it. So when you're in good health, you don't want to use a company that doesn't have good, solid financial ratings. And so most of the companies that are reputable and big-name companies have solid financial ratings across the board from all the independent rating companies. And that's, you know, sometimes you have to do some checking yourself and not always just rely on the advisor. So So unfortunately. But yes, the worst case scenario is if a company goes bankrupt, we've had that one situation that's the company's going through that. The worst case scenario is every state requires insurance companies to put money into a fund that is available for this situation. If a company goes bankrupt, then there's money available for people who need to collect out of the policy.
But sometimes that can take years.
It may not be
the same amount
of coverage also. But yeah, and that's, so it's the first time we've had that in my experience of almost 20 years. So it's still being worked out to see what's going to happen to the policyholders.
I think this situation speaks to how uncertain the times are that we live in. And if you've done everything right and you've planned and you've worked hard, you would expect things to be more expectable, right?
Predictable.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
But in fact, they're not. And the studies are now showing that the predictability is actually lessening because change has accelerated so much in our culture, not just in the United States, but around the world. And so of all the qualities that you bring into this third chapter of life, probably the most important is the fact that you've been through tough times before and you have resilience and you have strategies and you have a support network. The difficulty becomes as you age that you have less energy to take on the problems and your support network begins to fall away because most of our support network is our age, right? And so that's the difficulty. Things will change. They will change more rapidly than they have in the past, but you have this core of resilience that has gotten you through everything else in your life. And to the extent that you can rely on that and nurture that and honor that in your own lives, I think it stands you in really good stead for the future, despite the unpredictability.
Hi, as a follow-up to the follow-up, just wondering, for long-term care insurance, if you bought it, say, when you're in your 40s, now you're in your 60s or whatever, but over time you're monitoring the condition of the insurance company and you notice that it's slipping, is there any action that you can take to say, I want to change companies, or you basically you start a whole underwriting process again every time?
Denise, you can correct me if I'm wrong. You can nod or not. You have to start the whole process all over again because the company that you're going to go with the new policy, they're going to look at the risk of where you're at right now in that moment in time.
It's very difficult because long-term care insurance feels like medical insurance, but it's not. I mean, I always talk to people and say, you need to think about it more like the fire policy on your house, right? You buy it for a catastrophe, really, and you thank God every year that you didn't have to make a claim on your homeowner's policy, right? But we don't think of it that way. We think it's medical. It's like health insurance. And so just like if you changed your earthquake insurer or your homeowner's insurer, they would start with where you are. And on the one hand, you think, I've paid all this money, but on the other hand, thank God you didn't need the benefits. So it's kind of that sort of thing.
Unfortunately, our time is gone, but we want to thank our panel, our longevity panel, Mary Radu, Daniel Hannon, Elizabeth Kervatsi, for their remarks today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.